A great delight it was to feel that certainty again, to know that I could steer my fortune and the world's chance like a bobsled down the steep, dangerous hour. Since I still went roaming and prying about in my part as a restless, curious, dim-witted fellow, they wrote me on to the late watch shift. By midnight, all but I and one other late watcher within doors slept. I kept up my shiftless poking about the place, wandering up and down from time to time by the long beds. I settled my plans and began to ready my will and body to enter Dothi, for my own strength would never suffice unaided by the strength out of the dark. A while before dawn I went into the sleeping room once more, and with the cook's gun gave Genli I 1/100 second of stun to the brain, then hoisted him up, bag and all, and carried him out over my shoulder to the guard-room. "What's doing?" says the other guard, half asleep. "Let him be." "He's dead." "Another one dead? By Meshi's guts, and not hardly winter yet." He turned his head sideways to look into the envoy's face as it hung down on my back. "That one, the pervert it is, by the eye. I didn't believe all they say about car-hiders till I took a look at him, the ugly freak he is. He spent all week on the long bed moaning and sighing, but I didn't think he'd die right off like that. Well, go dump him outside where he'll keep till daylight. Don't stand there like a carry-loader with a sack of turds." I stopped by the inspection office on my way down the corridor, and I, being the guard, none stopped me from entering and looking till I found the wall panel that contained the alarms and switches. None was labeled, but guards had scratched letters beside the switches to jog their memory when haste was needed. Taking FF for fences, I turned that switch to cut the current to the outermost defenses of the farm, and then went on, pulling I along now by the shoulders. I came by the guard on duty in the watchroom by the door. I made a show of laboring to haul the dead load, for the Dothi strength was full within me, and I did not want it seen how easily, in fact, I could pull or carry the weight of a man heavier than myself. I said, "A dead prisoner. They said get him out of the sleeping room. Where do I stow him?" "I don't know. Get him outside. Under a roof so he won't get snowberried and float up stinking next spring in the thaws. It's snowing, Padisha." He meant that we call sove snow, a thick, wet fall. The best of news to me. All right," I said, and lugged my load outside and round the corner of the barracks out of his sight. I got I up over my shoulders again, went northeast a few hundred yards, clambered up over the dead fence, and slung my burden down, jumped down free, took up I once more, and made off as fast as I could towards the river. I was not far from the fence when a whistle began to shriek and the floodlights went on. It snowed hard enough to hide me, but not hard enough to hide my tracks within minutes. Yet when I got down to the river, they were not yet on my trail. I went north on clear ground under the trees, or through the water when there was no clear ground. The river, a hasty little tributary of the Isigal, was still unfrozen. Things were growing plain now in the dawn, and I went fast. In full Dothi, I found the envoy, though a long, awkward load, no heavy one. Following the stream into the forest, I came to the ravine where my sledge was, and onto the sledge I strapped the envoy, loading my stuff around and over him till he was well hidden, and a weather sheet over all. Then I changed clothes and ate some food from my pack, for the great hunger one feels in long-sustained Dothi was already gnawing at me. Then I set off north, on the main forest road. Before long, a pair of skiers came up with me. I was now dressed and equipped as a trapper, and told them that I was trying to catch up with Mavriva's outfit, which had gone north in the last days of Grendi. They knew Mavriva and accepted my story after a glance at my trapper's license. They were not expecting to find the escaped men heading north, for nothing lies north of Pulafin but the forest and the ice. They were perhaps not very interested in finding the escaped men at all. Why should they be? They went on, and only an hour later passed me again on their way back to the farm. One of them was the fellow I had stood late watch with. He had never seen my face, though he had had it before his eyes half the night. When they were surely gone, I turned off the road and all that day followed a long half-circle back through the forest and the foothills east of the farm, coming in at last from the east, from the wilderness to the hidden dell above Turriff where I had cached all my spare equipment. It was hard sledging in that much-folded land, with more than my weight to pull. But the snow was thick and already growing firm, and I was in Dothi. I had to maintain the condition, for once one lets the Dothi strength lapse, one is good for nothing at all. I had never maintained Dothi before for over an hour or so, but I knew that some of the old men can keep in the full strength for a day and a night, or even longer, and my present need proved a good supplement to my training. In Dothi one does not worry much, and what anxiety I had was for the envoy, who should have waked long ago from the light dose of sonic I had given him. He never stirred, and I had no time to tend to him. Was his body so alien that what to us is mere paralysis was death to him? When the wheel turns under your hand, you must watch your words, and I had twice called him dead, and carried him as the dead are carried. The thought would come that this was then a dead man that I hauled across the hills, and that my luck and his life had gone to waste after all. At that I would sweat and swear, and the Dothi strength would seem to run out of me like water out of a broken jar. But I went on, and the strength did not fail me till I had reached the cache in the foothills and set up the tent, and done what I could for I opened a box of hyper-food cubes, most of which I devoured, but some of which I got into him as a broth, for he looked near to starving. There were ulcers on his arms and breast, kept raw by the filthy sleeping bag he lay in. When these sores were cleansed and he lay warm in the fur bag, as well hidden as winter and wilderness could hide him, there was no more I could do. Night had fallen, and the greater darkness, the payment for the voluntary summoning of the body's full strength, was coming hard upon me. To darkness I must entrust myself and him. We slept. Snow fell. All the night and day and night on my Thangan sleep it must have snowed. No blizzard, but the first great snowfall of winter. When at last I roused and pulled myself up to look out, the tent was half buried. Sunlight and blue shadows lay vivid on the snow. Far and high in the east, one drift of gray dimmed the sky's brightness. The smoke of Udanushriki, nearest to us of the Fire Hills. Around the little peak of the tent lay the snow, mounds, hillocks, swells, slopes, all white, untrodden. Being still in the recovery period, I was very weak and sleepy, but whenever I could rouse myself, I gave I broth, a little at a time. And in the evening of that day he came to life, if not to his wits. He sat up crying out as if in great terror. When I knelt by him, he struggled to get away from me, and the effort being too much for him, fainted. That night he talked much, in no tongue I knew. It was strange in that dark stillness of the wilds to hear him mutter words of a language he had learned on another world than this. The next day was hard, for whenever I tried to look after him, he took me, I think, for one of the guards at the farm, and was in terror that I would give him some drug. He would break out into Argata and Karhaidish, all babbled pitifully together, begging me not to, and he fought me with a panic strength. This happened again and again, and as I was still in Thangan and weak of limb and will, it seemed I could not care for him at all. That day I thought that they had not only drugged, but mind-changed him, leaving him insane or imbecile. Then I wished that he had died on the sledge in the Thor forest, or that I had never had any luck at all, but had been arrested as I left Mishnori and sent to some farm to work out my own damnation. I woke from sleep, and he was watching me. "Estervan?" he said in a weak, amazed whisper. Then my heart lifted up. I could reassure him and see to his needs, and that night we both slept well. The next day he was much improved and sat up to eat. The sores on his body were healing. I asked him what they were. "I don't know. I think the drugs caused them. They kept giving me injections." "To prevent Kemmer?" That was one report I had heard from men escaped or released from voluntary farms. "Yes, and others. I don't know what they were. Theridicals of some kind. They made me ill. And they kept giving them to me. What were they trying to find out? What could I tell them? They may have not so much been questioning as domesticating you. Domesticating? Rendering you docile by a forced addiction to one of the Orgravy derivatives. That practice is not unknown in Carhide. Or they may have been carrying out an experiment on you and the others. I have been told they test mind-changing drugs and techniques on prisoners in the farms. I doubted that when I heard it. Not now. You have these farms in Carhide? In Carhide, I said. No. He rubbed his head fretfully. They'd say in Mishnori that there are no such places in Orgrin, I suppose. On the contrary, they'd boast of them, and show you tapes and pictures of the voluntary farms, where deviates are rehabilitated, and vestigial tribal groups are given refuge. They might show you around the first district voluntary farm just outside Mishnori, a fine showplace from all accounts. If you believe that we have farms in Carhide, Mr. I, you overestimate us seriously. We are not a sophisticated people. He lay a long time staring at the glowing chubby stove, which I had turned up till it gave out suffocating heat. Then he looked at me. You told me this morning, I know, but my mind wasn't clear, I think. Where are we? How did we get here? I told him again. You simply walked out with me? Mr. I, any one of you prisoners, or all of you together, could have walked out of that place any night. If you weren't starved, exhausted, demoralized, and drugged, and if you had winter clothing, and if you had somewhere to go. There's the catch. Where would you go? To a town? No papers, you're done for. Into the wilderness? No shelter, you're done for. In summer, I expect they bring more guards into Pullifen Farm. In winter, they use winter itself to guard it. He was scarcely listening. You couldn't carry me 100 feet, Estravan, let alone run, carrying me a couple of miles cross-country in the dark. I was in Dothi. He hesitated. Voluntarily induced? Yes. You are one of the Handarata? I was brought up in the Handara, and indwelt 2 years at Rothera Fastness. In Kermland, most people of the Inner Hearths are Handarata. I thought that after the Dothi period, the extreme drain on one's energy necessitated a sort of collapse. Yes, Thangan, it's called. The dark sleep. It lasts much longer than the Dothi period. And once you enter the recovery period, it's very dangerous to try to resist it. I slept straight through 2 nights. I'm still in Thangan now. I couldn't walk over the hill. And hunger's part of it. I've eaten up most of the rations I'd planned to last me the week. All right, he said with peevish haste. I see. I believe you. What can I do but believe you? Here I am, here you are, but I don't understand. I don't understand what you did all this for. At that, my temper broke, and I must stare at the ice knife which lay close by my hand, not looking at him and not replying until I had controlled my anger. Fortunately, there was not yet much heat or quickness in my heart. And I said to myself that he was an ignorant man, a foreigner, ill-used and frightened. So I arrived at justice and said finally, I feel that it is in part my fault that you came to Orgrin, and so to Pullifen Farm. I am trying to amend my fault. You had nothing to do with my coming to Orgrin. Mr. I, we've seen the same events with different eyes. I wrongly thought they'd seem the same to us. Let me go back to last spring. I began to encourage King Argovan to wait, to make no decision concerning you or your mission. About a half month before the day of the ceremony of the Keystone. The audience was already planned, and it seemed best to go through with it, though without looking for any results from it. All this I thought you understood, and in that I erred. I took too much for granted. I didn't wish to offend you, to advise you. I thought you understood the danger of Pemerhagirem Irtibi's sudden ascendancy in the Kiremi. If Tibi had known any good reason to fear you, he would have accused you of serving a faction. An Argovan, who is very easily moved by fear, would likely have had you murdered. I wanted you down and safe while Tibby was up and powerful. As it chanced, I went down with you. I was bound to fall, though I didn't know it would be that very night we talked together. But no one is Argovan's prime minister for long. After I received the order of exile, I could not communicate with you, lest I contaminate you with my disgrace, and so increase your peril. I came here to Orgrin. I tried to suggest to you that you should also come to Orgrin. I urged the men I distrusted least among the 33 commensals to grant you entry. You would not have got it without their favor. They saw, and I encouraged them to see, in you a way towards power, a way out of the increasing rivalry with Carhide, and back towards the restoration of open trade, a chance perhaps to break the grip of the Sarf. But they are overcautious men, afraid to act. Instead of proclaiming you, they hid you, and so lost their chance, and sold you to the Sarf to save their own pelts. I counted too much on them, and therefore the fault is mine. But for what purpose all this intriguing, this hiding and power-seeking and plotting? What was it all for, Estrivan? What were you after? I was after what you're after, the alliance of my world with your worlds. What did you think? We were staring at each other across the glowing stove like a pair of wooden dolls. You mean, even if it was Orgrin that made the alliance? Even if it was Orgrin. Carhide would soon have followed. Do you think I would play Shifgathor when so much is at stake for all of us, all my fellow men? What does it matter which country wakens first, so long as we waken? How the devil can I believe anything you say? He burst out. Bodily weakness made his indignation sound aggrieved and whining. If all this is true, you might have explained some of it earlier, last spring, and spared us both a trip to Polithon. Your efforts on my behalf have failed, and have put you in pain and shame and danger. I know it, but if I had tried to fight Tibby for your sake, you would not be here now. You'd be in a grave in Erenrong. And there are now a few people in Carhide, and a few in Orgrin, who believe your story because they listen to me. They may yet serve you. My greatest error was, as you say, in making myself clear to you. I'm not used to doing so. I am not used to giving or accepting either advice or blame. I don't mean to be unjust, Estrivan, yet you are. It is strange. I am the only man in all Gethin that has trusted you entirely, and I am the only man in Gethin that you have refused to trust. He put his head in his hands. He said at last, I'm sorry, Estrivan. It was both apology and admission. The fact is, I said, that you're unable or unwilling to believe in the fact that I believe in you. I stood up, for my legs were cramped, and found I was trembling with anger and weariness. Teach me your mind speech, I said, trying to speak easily and with no rancor. Your language that has no lies in it. Teach me that, and then ask me why I did what I've done. I should like to do that, Estrivan. Chapter 15. To the Ice. I awoke. Up until now it had been strange, unbelievable, to wake up inside a dim cone of warmth, and to hear my reason tell me that it was a tent, that I lay in it alive, that I was not still in Polithon Farm. This time there was no strangeness in my waking, but a grateful sense of peace. Sitting up, I yawned and tried to comb back my matted hair with my fingers. I looked at Estrivan, stretched out sound asleep on his sleeping bag a couple of feet from me. He wore nothing but his breeches. He was hot. The dark, secret face was laid bare to the light, to my gaze. Estrivan, asleep, looked a little stupid, like everyone asleep. A round, strong face, relaxed and remote, small drops of sweat on the upper lip and over the heavy eyebrows. I remember how he had stood sweating on the parade stand in Erenrong, in panoply of rank and sunlight. I saw him now defenseless and half-naked in a colder light, and for the first time saw him as he was. He woke late and was slow in waking. At last he staggered up, yawning, pulled on his shirt, stuck his head out to judge the weather, and then asked me if I wanted a cup of Orsch. When he found that I had crawled about and brewed up a pot of the stuff with the water he had left in a pan as ice on the stove last night, he accepted a cup, thanked me stiffly, and sat down to drink it. "Where do we go from here, Estevan?" "It depends on where you want to go, Mr. I, and on what kind of travel you can manage." "What's the quickest way out of Orgrun?" "West. To the coast, 30 miles or so." "What then?" "The harbors will be freezing, or already frozen, here. In any case, no ships go out far in winter. It would be a matter of waiting and hiding somewhere until next spring, when the great traders go out to Sith and Perenter. None will be going to Carhide if the trade embargoes continue. We might work our passage on a trader. I am out of money, unfortunately." "Is there any alternative?"
"Carhide, overland."
"How far is it? 1,000 miles?
"Yes, by road. But we couldn't go on the roads. We wouldn't get past the first inspector. Our only way would be north, through the mountains, east across the Gobrin, and down to the border at Guthan Bay."
"Across the Gobrin, the ice sheet, you mean?"
He nodded.
"It's not possible in winter, is it?"
"I think so, with luck, as in all winter journeys. In one respect, a glacier crossing is better in winter. The good weather, you know, tends to stay over the great glaciers where the ice reflects the heat of the sun. The storms are pushed out to the periphery. Therefore, the legends about the place inside the blizzard.
That might be in our favor. Little else."
"Then you seriously think?" "There would have been no point taking you from Pullifan Farm if I did not." He was still stiff, sore, grim. Last night's conversation had shaken us both.
"And I take it that you consider the ice crossing a better risk than waiting about till spring for a sea crossing."
He nodded. "Solitude," he explained, laconic. I thought it over for a while. "I hope you've taken my inadequacies into account. I'm not as cold-proof as you. Nowhere near it. I'm no expert on skis. I'm not in good shape, though much improved from a few days ago." Again he nodded. "I think we might make it," he said, with that complete simplicity I had so long taken for irony.
"All right." He glanced at me and drank down his cup of tea. Tea, it might as well be called. Brewed from roasted perm grain, Orsch is a brown, sweet-sour drink, strong in vitamins A and C, sugar, and a pleasant stimulant related to lobeline. Where there is no beer on winter, there is Orsch. Where there is neither beer nor Orsch, there are no people.
"It will be hard," he said, setting down his cup. "Very hard. Without luck, we will not make it. I'd rather die up on the ice than in that cesspool you got me out of." He cut off a chunk of dried bread apple, offered me a slice, and sat meditatively chewing. "We'll need more food," he said. "What happens if we do make it to Carhide? To you, I mean. You're still proscribed."
He turned his dark otter's glance on me. "Yes, I suppose I'd stay on this side. And when they found you'd helped their prisoner escape, they needn't find it." He smiled bleak and said, "First we have to cross the ice." I broke out, "Listen, Estevan, will you forgive me what I said yesterday?"
"Nasooth."
He stood up, still chewing, put on his yeb, coat, and boots, and slipped otter-like out the self-sealing valved door. From outside, he stuck his head back in. "I may be late or gone overnight. Can you manage here?"
"Yes."
"All right." With that, he was off. I never knew a person who reacted so wholly and rapidly to a changed situation as Estevan. I was recovering and willing to go. He was out of Thangan. The instant that was all clear, he was off. He was never rash or hurried, but he was always ready. It was the secret, no doubt, of the extraordinary political career he threw away for my sake. It was also the explanation of his belief in me and devotion to my mission. When I came, he was ready. Nobody else on Winter was.
Yet he considered himself a slow man, poor in emergencies. Once he told me that being so slow-thinking, he had to guide his acts by a general intuition of which way his luck was running, and that this intuition rarely failed him. He said it seriously. It may have been true. The foretellers of the fastnesses are not the only people on Winter who can see ahead. They have tamed and trained the hunch, but not increased its certainty. In this matter, the Omeshta also have a point. The gift is perhaps not strictly or simply one of foretelling, but is rather the power of seeing, if only for a flash, everything at once. Seeing whole. I kept the little heater stove at its hottest setting while Estevan was gone, and so got warm clear through for the first time in how long? I thought it must be Thurn by now, the first month of winter, and of a new year one, but I had lost count in Polyphon. The stove was one of those excellent and economical devices perfected by the Gathenians in their millennial effort to outwit cold. Only the use of a fusion pack as power source could improve it. Its bionic-powered battery was good for 14 months' continuous use. Its heat output was intense. It was stove, heater, and lantern all in one, and it weighed about 4 pounds. We would never have got 50 miles without it. It must have cost a good deal of Estevan's money, that money I had loftily handed over to him in Mishnori. The tent, which was made of plastics developed for weather resistance and designed to cope with at least some of the inside water condensation that is the plague of tents in cold weather. The pessary fur sleeping bags, the clothes, skis, sledge, food supplies, everything was of the finest make and kind, lightweight, durable, expensive. If he had gone to get more food, what was he going to get it with? He did not return till nightfall next day. I had gone out several times on snowshoes, gathering strength, and getting practice by waddling around the slopes of the snowy vale that hid our tent. I was competent on skis, but not much good on snowshoes. I dared not go far over the hilltops, lest I lose my backtrack. It was wild country, steep, full of creeks and ravines, rising fast to the cloud-haunted mountains eastward. I had time to wonder what I would do in this forsaken place if Estevan did not come back. He came swooping over the dusky hill. He was a magnificent skier, and stopped beside me, dirty and tired and heavy-laden. He had on his back a huge sooty sack stuffed full of bundles. Father Christmas, who pops down the chimneys of old earth. The bundles contained caddick germ, dried bread apple, tea, and slabs of the hard, red, earthy-tasting sugar that Gathenians refine from one of their tubers. "How did you get all this?" "Stole it," said the one-time Prime Minister of Karhide, holding his hands over the stove, which he had not yet turned down. Even he was cold. "In Turf, close thing. That was all I ever learned." He was not proud of his exploit, and not able to laugh at it. Stealing is a vile crime on Winter. Indeed, the only man more despised than the thief is the suicide. "We'll use up this stuff first," he said, as I set a pan of snow on the stove to melt. "It's heavy." Most of the food he had laid in previously was hyper-food rations, a fortified, dehydrated, compressed, cubed mixture of high-energy foods. The Argota name for it is Gitchi-Michi, and that's what we called it, though of course we spoke Karhidish together. We had enough of it to last us 60 days at the minimal standard ration, 1 pound a day apiece. After he had washed up and eaten, Estevan sat a long time by the stove that night, figuring out precisely what we had and how and when we must use it. We had no scales, and he had to estimate, using a pound box of Gitchi-Michi as standard. He knew, as do many Gathenians, the caloric and nutritive value of each food. He knew his own requirements under various conditions, and how to estimate mine pretty closely. Such knowledge has high survival value on Winter. When at last he had got our rations planned out, he rolled over onto his bag and went to sleep. During the night I heard him talking numbers out of his dreams, weights, days, distances. We had, very roughly, 800 miles to go. The first 100 would be north or northeast, going through the forest and across the northernmost spurs of the Sembenchen Range to the Great Glacier, the ice sheet that covers the double-lobed Great Continent everywhere north of the 45th parallel, and in places dips down almost to the 35th. One of these southward extensions is in the region of the Fire Hills, the last peaks of the Sembenchens, and that region was our first goal. There, among the mountains, Estevan reasoned, we should be able to get onto the surface of the ice sheet, either descending onto it from a mountain slope or climbing up to it on the slope of one of its effluent glaciers. Thereafter, we would travel on the ice itself, eastward, for some 600 miles. Where its edge trends north again, near the Bay of Guthen, we would come down off it and cut southeast a last 50 or 100 miles across the Senche Bogs, which by then should be 10 or 20 feet deep in the snow, to the Karhaidish border. This route kept us clear from start to finish of inhabited or inhabitable country. We would not be meeting any inspectors. This was indubitably of the first importance. I had no papers, and Estevan said that his wouldn't hold up under any further forgeries. In any case, though I could pass for a Guthenian when no one expected anything else, I was not disguisable to an eye looking for me. In this respect, then, the way Estevan proposed for us was highly practical. In all other respects, it seemed perfectly insane. I kept my opinion to myself, for I fully meant what I'd said about preferring to die escaping if it came down to a choice of deaths. Estevan, however, was still exploring alternatives. Next day, which we spent in loading and packing the sledge very carefully, he said, "If you raise the starship, when might it come?" "Anywhere between 8 days and a half month, depending on where it is in its solar orbit relative to Geffen. It might be on the other side of the sun." "No sooner?" "No sooner. The Nafel motive can't be used within a solar system. The ship can come in only on rocket drive, which puts her at least 8 days away." "Why?" He tugged a cord tight and knotted it before he answered. "I was considering the wisdom of trying to ask aid from your world, as mine seems unhelpful. There's a radio beacon in Turf." "How powerful?" "Not very. The nearest big transmitter would be in Kuhumi, about 400 miles south of here." "Kuhumi's a big town, isn't it?" "A 250,000 souls." "We'd have to get the use of the radio transmitter somehow, then hide out for at least 8 days with the SARF alerted." "Not much chance." He nodded. I lugged the last sack of Kadic germ out of the tent, fitted it into its niche in the sledge load, and said, "If I had called the ship that night in Mishnori, the night you told me to, the night I was arrested..." But Absol had my ansible. Still has it, I suppose. "Can he use it?" "No, not even by chance, fiddling about. The coordinate settings are extremely complex. But if only I'd used it..." "If only I'd known the game was already over that day," he said, and smiled. He was not one for regrets. "You did, I think, but I didn't believe you." When the sledge was loaded, he insisted that we spend the rest of the day doing nothing, storing energy. He lay in the tent writing in a little notebook in his small, rapid, vertical cursive Karhaidish hand, the account that appears as the previous chapter. He hadn't been able to keep up his journal during the past month, and that annoyed him. He was pretty methodical about that journal. Its writing was, I think, both an obligation to and a link with his family, the Hearth of Esther. I learned that later, however. At the time, I didn't know what he was writing, and I sat waxing skis or doing nothing. I whistled a dance tune and stopped myself in the middle. We only had one tent, and if we were going to share it without driving each other mad, a certain amount of self-restraint, of manners, was evidently required. Estevan had looked up at my whistling all right, but not with irritation. He looked at me rather dreamily and said, "I wish I'd known about your ship last year. Why did they send you onto this world alone?" "The first envoy to a world always comes alone. One alien is a curiosity. Two are an invasion. The first envoy's life is held cheap." "No, the Ecumen really doesn't hold anybody's life cheap. So it follows, better to put one life in danger than 2 or 20. It's also very expensive and time-consuming, you know, shipping people over the big jumps. Anyhow, I asked for the job. In danger, honor, he said, evidently a proverb, for he added mildly, we'll be full of honor when we reach Carhide. When he spoke, I found myself believing that we would in fact reach Carhide, across 800 miles of mountain, ravine, crevasse, volcano, glacier, ice sheet, frozen bog or frozen bay, all desolate, shelterless, and lifeless, in the storms of midwinter, in the middle of an ice age. He sat writing up his records with the same obdurate, patient thoroughness I had seen in a mad king up on a scaffolding, mortaring a joint, and said, when we reach Carhide. His when was no mere dateless hope, either. He intended to reach Carhide by the fourth day of the fourth month of winter, Arhad Anur. We were to start tomorrow, the 13th of the first month, Tormenbad Thern. Our rations, as well as he could calculate, might be stretched at farthest to 3 Gathenian months, 78 days. So we would go 12 miles a day for 70 days and get to Carhide on Arhad Anur. That was all settled. No more to do now but get a good sleep. We set off at dawn, on snowshoes, in a thin, windless snowfall. The surface over the hills was Bessa, soft and still unpacked, what Terran skiers, I think, call wild snow. The sledge was heavily loaded. Estevan guessed the total weight to pull at something over 300 pounds. It was hard to pull in the fluffy snow, though it was as handy as a well-designed little boat. The runners were marvels, coated with a polymer that cut resistance almost to nothing. But of course that was no good when the whole thing was stuck in a drift. On such a surface, and going up and down slopes and gullies, we found it best to go one in harness pulling and one behind pushing. The snow fell fine and mild all day long. We stopped twice for a bite of food. In all the vast hilly country there was no sound. We went on, and all of a sudden it was twilight. We halted in a valley very like the one we had left that morning, a dell among white-humped hills. I was so tired I staggered, yet I could not believe the day was over. We had covered by the sledge meter almost 15 miles. If we could go that well in soft snow, fully loaded, through a steep country whose hills and valleys all ran athwart our way, then surely we could do better up on the ice, with hard snow, a level way, and a load always lighter. My trust in Estevan had been more willed than spontaneous. Now I believed him completely. We would be in Carhide in 70 days. You've traveled like this before, I asked him. Sledged? Often. Long hauls? I went a couple of 100 miles on the Kerm ice one autumn years ago. The lower end of Kermland, the mountainous southernmost peninsula of the Carhide semi-continent, is, like the north, glaciated. Humanity on the great continent of Gethin lives in a strip of land between 2 white walls. A further decrease of 8% in solar radiation, they calculate, would bring the walls creeping together. There would be no men, no land, only ice. What for? Curiosity? Adventure? He hesitated and smiled slightly. The augmentation of the complexity and intensity of the field of intelligent life, he said, quoting one of my ecumenical quotations. Ah, you were consciously extending the evolutionary tendency inherent in being, one manifestation of which is exploration. We were both well pleased with ourselves, sitting in the warm tent, drinking hot tea, and waiting for the caddic germ porridge to boil. That's it, he said, 6 of us, all very young, my brother and I from Esther, 4 of our friends from Stock. There was no purpose for the journey. We wanted to see Terramander, a mountain that stands up out of the ice down there. Not many people have seen it from the land. The porridge was ready, a different matter from the stiff bran mush of Pullifan Farm. It tasted like the roast chestnuts of Terra, and burned the mouth splendidly. Warm, though benevolent, I said, "The best food I've eaten on Gethin has always been in your company, Estevan." "Not at that banquet in Mishnori." "No, that's true. You hate Orgrin, don't you?" Very few are got to know how to cook. Hate Orgeron? No, how should I? How does one hate a country, a loved one? Tibby talks about it. I lack the trick of it. I know people, I know towns, farms, hills, and rivers and rocks. I know how the sun, at sunset in autumn, falls on the side of a certain plowland in the hills. But what is the sense of giving a boundary to all of that, of giving it a name and ceasing to love where the name ceases to apply? What is love of one's country? Is it hate of one's uncountry? Then it's not a good thing. Is it simply self-love? That's a good thing, but one mustn't make a virtue of it or a profession.